Hello everyone, thank you for coming today. We have a special guest, Dr. Rafael Zinides. She is an assistant professor at Sciences Po. Before this, she was a lecturer in Edinburgh, and she held multiple fellowships in multiple European universities, including me, and I was a Fulbrighter at Columbia Law School in New York. Rafael is also trained as both a political scientist and a lawyer. And it's my first time to meet her in person, but I met her scholarship and I was struck by the exceptional depth of her work. I have a chapter coming. I think she is the most cited paper in the chapter. Her explanation of CSRL was very exceptional and amazing. But not only the only thing that matches the depth of her scholarship is the width. So she writes about European fundamental rights, she writes about discrimination law, both in traditional sense and algorithmic bias as well, in digital and law and technology. She writes on sociology of law, as well as critical theory, which she will be discussing today. So I'll leave the floor with Rafael. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mohamed. This is such a kind introduction. It's my first time in Cambridge, and I'm very, very happy to be here with you and also to discover your wonderful intellectual community. So thank you so much for having me. I have chosen to present a paper that is still work in progress. Shouldn't be actually, because it's very late, but it is. And so I'd be very happy to hear your comments on this work. The paper is entitled Anti-Discrimination Law in Europe Through the Lens of Critical Theory. And it sort of grasps struggles with the question of what's critical anti-discrimination law and critical approaches to anti-discrimination. And so it starts with an interrogation, which is, what is the role of EU anti-discrimination law today? And so if we look at the state of social Europe, we realize that the principle of non-discrimination on equal treatment plays a major role as a guardrail of those social guarantees, social justice, and solidarity. Although social Europe has become a constitutional pillar of EU integration, suffices to look at Title 10 of the TFEU, for example, it actually has not really been able to prevent the unraveling of national welfare states. And so that's what a scholar like Diamond Eshekbor, for example, diagnoses as the broken promise of embedded liberalism. So on the slides, you see examples of current transformations of national welfare states in Europe. And what's to note is that in a context of austerity politics that have been going on for several decades now, the so-called digital revolution mediates a turn towards securitization in the stead of solidarity and automated suspicion against the most precarious. And therefore, at national level, at least, solidarity becomes or comes into jeopardy and is replaced with efforts to cut costs, rationalize administrations, bureaucracies, increase efficiency, etc. So in this context, it seems to me that the principle of non-discrimination law, especially at European level, plays a big role to mitigate that kind of unraveling of the social promise. And it does so on in two aspects. First of all, non-discrimination based on nationality delivers a promise of transnationalizing solidarity, social justice, equality, with, of course, well-known limits posed by the Court of Justice. If we look at cases like Dano, Alimanovic, etc., we see that promise of transnational solidarity has important limits. But also, non-discrimination law and the principle of equal treatments serve as a distributional key to access resources. And when I think of resources, I think about it in a broad manner. So it could be opportunities, labor, social goods, access to social institutions, etc., etc. And so in these two contexts, the principle of non-discrimination embodies an emancipatory promise of freeing individuals from social structures of domination, oppression, exploitation, and inequality. And it seems like a lot relies or rests on this principle of non-discrimination in this specific context of austerity, in this specific political context. And scholars have theorized the role of non-discrimination in various ways. So liberal accounts protecting autonomy, deliberative freedoms, but also more, social accounts of discrimination. Think about it in terms of distributive justice, social recognition, etc., etc. But there's, of course, also some skepticism towards the ability of the principle of non-discrimination to take on such a big normative commitment as the one I've just described. And the critique goes specifically in one direction, which is to measure what non-discrimination law has been delivering, especially when shaped by the Court of Justice, against what its promise, its normative promise, seems to be. And so the traditional critique is that there is a substantive version of equality that has actually not been delivered. And that is because the principle of non-discrimination has been interpreted in a very formalistic manner. This is a very well-known critique. It's been embodied and articulated in particular by Sandra Fredman, who, you know, based on accounts by Nancy Fraser and Iris Marin Young, delineates a four-dimensional model of substantive equality. And she says, substantive equality should aim to redress disadvantage. So there is a material aspect to it. Address stigma, stereotyping, and prejudice, meaning, you know, ensure social recognition. But also enhance voice and participation and accommodate difference and achieve structural change. And so formal interpretations of equality, so the critic goes, fail to apply that model, and they mostly fall back on a sort of flat understanding of non-discrimination as a negative entitlement to sameness of treatment in a social void. And so that flattens the principle of non-discrimination law, that reduces it to a negative commitment to symmetrical treatment, and that ignores social hierarchies and power asymmetries that are at play in any given social context. But also it lacks a normative vision. And I'm especially puzzled by that last point, because although this model and this sort of analytical dichotomy is a very interesting and productive lens of inquiry, I'm wondering what it means when we say that the principle of non-discrimination law lacks a normative commitment. And so in this paper, I try to come to grip with the fact that the principle of non-discrimination, or the critique of non-discrimination law, remains implicit in its engagement with social theory. What is the social project that these critiques are anchored in when they make those claims? And so the idea of the paper is to spell out the theorization of society that actually underpin this normative critique, because as per the tradition of critical theory, a critical approach to anti-discrimination law must be concerned with the vision of society that such rules embody and the values that they reflect. So the paper asks, and this is in line and inspired by a paper written in 2022 by P.V. Nevonen, what rationalizations of society and what unpronounced assumptions of political reality, and I'm quoting her, do these critiques of anti-discrimination law utter? Or in other terms, what is critical and critical approaches to non-discrimination? And the idea here is to unpack the role of critical theory and the methods of inquiry of critical approaches to anti-discrimination. This is also a way to respond to political critiques about, you know, about non-discrimination itself and its role in society, but also scholarly critiques against critical theory. Critical theory is increasingly accused of, you know, lacking scientific methods, lacking positivism, and being biased on a sort of activist or militant project. And so the paper is concerned with interrogating the modes of epistemic production of anti-discrimination law. And this, I think, is a powerful move to counter those criticisms of critical theory. And so my paper asks how the principle of non-discrimination conditions, mediates, and constructs specific forms of individual subjectivity, but also interpersonal relationships, institutional arrangements, material and spatial organization, and ultimately social order. So going from the micro to the macro, what society does anti-discrimination actually construct, as it's been shaped by legislative intervention, but also jurisprudential construction. So the project of the paper is to uncover what social forms and what order legal norms produce, and to also offer an alternative imaginary, because of course deconstruction is the condition for reconstruction. Within the context or to give you a little bit more context on the paper, this is going to be a chapter in a book edited by Päivi Novonen and Paul Lindenrettig. And the book is on EU law and critical theory. And so it mixes different fields and different approaches. And it interrogates what critical law, what critical theory can add or how it can inform EU law and EU law analysis. And I think this comes nicely within a context where, you know, people have been speaking about a methodological turn in EU law. So a sort of reflexive moment where scholars in EU law are questioning their positions, their interventions, and also their relationship with EU law. And I'm thinking about projects like Vincent Reveillère's cycle of conferences on EU law and methods, but also projects like Ivana Izailovic, Michael Madsen, Fernanda Nicola, Yola Solanke, Antoine Vaucher, etc. So research in this field seems to me appears ripe for a reflexive interest. And that's what I'm trying to do with this chapter. So what the editors of the book were asking of contributors was to attempt to perform an immanent critique of different fields of EU law. And it seems to me that in order to do that, we first need to understand what's the project of anti-discrimination law in order to know whether it's been successful or not. So this is what I'm trying to do here. And so here's the roadmap of the talk. I target my inquiry at three levels. So as I told you, micro, meso, and macro. And every time, at every level of analysis, I try to propose a counter critical move to see what that can do in reconstructing anti-discrimination. The first one is at the micro level of individual subjectivity. And the question here is, how does EU anti-discrimination engineer legal subjectivity? So meaning what subjects does it construct, recognize, but also erases and excludes? And so this is a sort of classical inquiry, but the project is to propose a counter move by re-embodying EU law at this level. And by re-embodying, I mean excavating the forms of subjectivity that are outside of the scope of anti-discrimination law that are erased by EU anti-discrimination norms. Then at the meso level, I look at categories. Categories are a classical device in anti-discrimination law because this corpus of norms protects specific grounds of discrimination. So prohibits discrimination, for example, based on sex, gender, age, religion, sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. And those categories play a very important role in any anti-discrimination analysis. And so what the chapter does is to try and understand how those categories stabilize and legitimate certain forms of social community, social relations, and excludes also some sets of interpersonal relationships from the scope of anti-discrimination. And the critical move that I propose here is to trouble those categories, to sort of contest or challenge the boundaries that they are constructing, to bring into legibility forms of social communities, forms of social relations that anti-discrimination expulses or expels. At the macro level, we go one up every time, and so this interrogates what social order anti-discrimination law engineers. And here, the critical move that I propose is to disenchant the narrative. So both narratives of EU integration, as you know, a form of an ever closer community, so to say, but also anti-discrimination law as a device for actually protecting different ways of life. And here, the aim of the chapter is to understand how EU anti-discrimination law orders society, but also excludes very specific forms of alternatives. And of course, as per critical theory, this is the condition for re-enchanting the narrative and the future, if we want to end on a more positive note. So here the chapter draws from different strands of critical theory. And I was telling Mohamed earlier that this was maybe the most difficult part of the chapter, to sort of position myself within this vast field of critiques. Also because I was telling him I don't know everything, but also I don't want to subsume the chapter on the sort of critical intervention into one specific project. So it's a bit of a mix, and it invokes interventions ranging from materialist accounts to post-structuralist perspectives and feminist legal studies. And so without really ambitioning to reconstruct any of those genealogies, it sort of picks from those different critical moves to try and make sense of EU anti-discrimination law. And one central methodological intervention that the chapter performs is distributional analysis. And it seems to me that I have to tell you how I understand it, because this can be interpreted in a variety of forms. And I see it not only as a material project, so not only interrogating the material distribution that legal norms perform, that would be an approach, you know, that you could associate with someone like Duncan Kennedy, for instance. And so that would be centered on how EU anti-discrimination would distribute wealth, resources, power, labor opportunities, things like that. But also in a more sort of traditional, a more feminist perspective, I conceive of distribution in a much broader sense, as, you know, allow me to think about how legal rules allocate not only resources, but maybe prestige, space, voice, status, could be pain, could be honor, it could be visibility, agency, etc., etc. So a much broader understanding of what distribution actually means. For that, I've used Janet Halley's contributions on feminist governance, where she says that a distributional analysis is oriented not to the symbolic norm announcing function of law, but to their distributional consequences. So how law sets in motion a chain of further distributional changes and reinforces or unravels accumulation and impoverishment dynamics. So this is a vast project, and I wouldn't be able to do that across the wide spectrum of anti-discrimination law. So I've chosen two cases on which I've been recently writing. And those are the SCRL case that Mohamed mentioned just earlier, and the Commune Dense case. And those are the two most recent decisions of the Court of Justice on religious discrimination at work. There's a directive protecting employees from religious discrimination. This has come to interpretation in those two cases. In one case, the SCRL case, it was a private organization. It was actually an intern who had informed the employer that she would wear a headscarf when coming to work. And the internship offer was no longer made to her after this piece of information was given. And in Commune Dense, it was a Belgian municipality that had a so-called strict neutrality policy. So instead of only requiring their employees to not wear any sign of religious affiliation when facing public users, it also asked of them to be neutral, religiously neutral, in their interactions with other employees. And that's what they called a strict neutrality policy. And in both cases, the reason why both cases are interesting is that they also follow up on a much richer discussion that has been taking place at the Court of Justice since 2015. And that's where 10 years ago, the two first references on religious discrimination were introduced. And those were the cases of Ashbita and Bougnaoui. And in those cases, one of the major questions was whether a general rule prohibiting any sign of religious affiliation, but also philosophical or cultural expression, was to be conceived as a form of direct discrimination. And just as a to explain a little bit what the difference between direct and indirect discrimination is, so we're all on the same page, the directive which I mentioned, and more generally EU anti-discrimination law, distinguishes between two forms of discrimination. Direct discrimination is, let's say, a rule, a criterion or practice that explicitly mentions a protected ground. So let's say, think about a trivial example. You're an employer, you want to recruit security staff, and you want them to be men because somehow you hold the view that they will be more effective in, you know, deterring people from making trouble. And so you say, I call for applications in this field and I want male applicants. That is direct discrimination. It's a bit of a, you know, schematic example, but that's direct discrimination because it explicitly uses a protected ground to select candidates. By contrast, indirect discrimination is when you have a rule that is apparently neutral, but has the effect of disadvantaging a protected group. And so in my example, if you said, I want security staff, but I want every candidate to be above 1.75 meters in height, then that is a rule that is apparently neutral. It doesn't use any gender criterion, but it has a disproportionate effect on women by excluding them from applying to the position. And so this distinction is actually key in non-discrimination law because direct discrimination suffers almost no exception. And again, this is a simplification, but you'd have a very few or a very narrow list of exceptions explicitly stated in the law that you can avail of, whereas indirect discrimination is always subjected to an open-ended justification test. So here you have the classical proportionality test with a legitimate aim, adequate means, and an assessment of the necessity of the measure at stake. So in the case of our rule saying, you know, people above 175 meters, the employer could justify that by saying, you know, well, the aim is legitimate. I want those security people to be effective on the ground. It could be deemed appropriate as well, but the court would probably say, well, you'd have to show necessity, right? You'd have to show that it's only targeting those people who are actually going to face possible trouble on the ground, and not a blanket rule for every one of your employees. And so that distinction has come to be discussed extensively in cases of religious discrimination since Ashbita, because the court persisted in saying that a rule prohibiting any type of religious clothing would not constitute direct discrimination because it would target all employees in the same manner. And so there are two obvious counterarguments to that. The first one is that it actually uses the word religion. So it's a rule that prohibits religious clothing. And so, you know, it could be challenged on that ground. But also, because of the effect in specific local contexts that are highly correlated with very well identifiable social groups, in particular Muslim women who want to wear the headscarf at work, this rule could be, this understanding of direct discrimination and indirect discrimination could be called into question. The second reason why those cases are interesting is that the court has used neutrality in a myriad of ways without really unpacking what neutrality means. And in those cases, in commune dans, for instance, it said a strict neutrality policy is acceptable provided it is consistently applied across the employment context. And that does something to social order, and that does something to the model of society that EU anti-discrimination law constructs or mediates. And that's what I'm trying to unpack in the chapter. So let's start with the first level, the first intervention at the micro level. Here, the aim is to re-embody EU anti-discrimination law, and that aims to answer the following questions. Who are the protected subjects of EU anti-discrimination law? What bodies, modes of existence, and forms of subjectivity does it see or does it render legible? And in turn, what epistemic erasures does it perform? And here I start from Miranda Fricke's account of epistemic oppressions. So she says there is a certain epistemological reading of structures of domination, and that implies that the powerful have some sort of unfair advantage in structuring our understanding of the social world. And so that is a way to say actually anti-discrimination law is constructed by the powerful for the powerful. And in sort of constructing reality or approximating reality, it erases certain subjects. And in particular, it produces epistemic oppression by fantasizing a legal subject that is completely disembodied. So here the court uses freedom of religion and the freedom from discrimination based on religion as a complete disembodied concept. And so that produces a form of hermeneutical injustice because it excludes some of the social and corporeal experiences of most marginalized communities from the collective understanding of what discrimination is. And specifically, in Ashbita, Wabern Müller, which was a follow-up case, but also in SCRL and Commune Dans, the two cases which I'm focusing on, the neutrality rules prohibit the wearing of the Islamic headscarf at work. And the framing of these cases as religious discrimination erases the intersectional experiences of those subjects. And so, Sheila Benabib says, for example, we see that those discussions on religion, on freedom of religion, render women and their bodies as objects of disciplinary conflicts in culture, law, and religion. And this is exactly what happens in SCRL and Commune Dans. The way the court polices the contours of non-discrimination based on religion excludes specifically those bodies. And it extracts those religious subjects from structures of gender and racial oppressions. The court is specifically prompted to think not about race discrimination, unfortunately, but about gender discrimination. In those two cases, by the litigants, there have been lengthy submissions at national level. And I've also interviewed Véronique van der Planck, who was the lawyer in LF, and she confirmed that intersectionality was used and mobilized in those cases. And the court completely disregards that by saying, you know, there's nothing to say about gender discrimination here, and there's no evidence. And so here, I think the court fragments the legal subject and conditions its legibility to the applicant's ability to fold themselves within this disembodied notion of religion that you know, is at the core of their understanding of non-discrimination. And therefore, that renders eligible any racialization dynamics and any gendered exclusion that comes with this notion of religion. In addition to that, the refusal to recognize those neutrality rules as forms of direct discrimination has been contested, most notably by former Advocate General Sharpstone, who says in her shadow opinion in Waber and Müller that those rules very foreseeably, in very predictable manners, exclude a clearly identifiable minority. And therefore, this can be challenged as well, because whereas direct discrimination would have allowed to say, well, you know, the employer must take upon themselves the burden of accommodating or you know, rejecting stereotypes, the framework of indirect discrimination allows them to put forward a justification which embeds considerations such as freedom to conduct business, for instance, in the case of LF, and therefore non-discrimination law sort of yields to other considerations, other interests and rights, instead of performing on its mandate to protect legal subjects. And so those rules produce disembodiment by legitimizing those neutrality policies and the reading of religion that the court performs, this immaterial understanding of religion, doesn't take into account forms of religion that have, in particular, a forum externum. You know, Article 10 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights recognizes that religion consists of two aspects, a forum internum, so the beliefs that you hold, but also a forum externum, the any sign manifestation of religion. And so if you read the case with attention, the court actually says in between the lines that, so it's almost it's a preteritio, it doesn't really say it. It says, we don't even need to go to that argument, but actually, the headcraft can be understood as a form of proselytizing, so sort of a sort of attempt to convince others that Islam is the form of religion that should be adopted, as opposed to an understanding of the headscarf as a manifestation simply of one's beliefs. And so this goes really, really far in constructing religion, policing the contours of religion, and as a consequence, excluding certain forms of subjectivity from the scope of non-discrimination. And so the re-embodying move here allows to see that and interrogate how the concept of neutrality actually implicitly accommodates dominant majority forms, majority understandings of religion, and erases also certain subjects. So it's I would frame it as a strategy of epistemic resistance. The second intervention, and I'm going to try and be a bit more quicker, is at the meso level. The intervention here seeks to trouble the categories of anti-discrimination law. And as I told you, those categories, categorization, is an inherent operation of non-discrimination. any anti-discrimination law, not any, but actually most anti-discrimination law corpuses rely on protected grounds in order to allocate rights and so and in order to seize inequalities. And so lived experiences have to be subsumed legally within one protected category or several when that's possible, in order to be rendered legible as a form of unlawful discrimination. So that is sex, race or ethnic origin, religion or beliefs, etc. So those categories serve as proxies to capture vectors of discrimination, and they are hermeneutical devices that allow making sense of these experiences as unlawful discrimination. But these categories should be used as analytical cues, so to say. And very often they're used, they're construed and operationalized to limit the scope of anti-discrimination. And that's what happens here. The intervention seeks to trouble those categories to sort of reintegrate some lived experiences within the scope of anti-discrimination. And in particular, what's at stake here is the epistemological commitment to individualism that the court has at its core when it reads those categories of discrimination. And once again, when we look at religion, the way the court understands religion is as an individual choice. So this is based on, you know, a very liberal understanding of agency that isolates the subject, the agent, and understands religion as a choice that that person can make or not make. And so when condoning neutrality rules, what the Court of Justice is saying is practically, well, in order to continue working at the municipality of Ons, what you would have to do is actually to come to work removing your headscarf. And this is framed in a milder way. Of course, you know, the national court will ultimately decide whether this is proportionate or not. But in Ashbita, the court had already said, well, you know, maybe terminating a worker, the contract of a worker who wears a headscarf, is a bit radical, and what we should do instead is put her in a place where she has no interaction with clients. And so, you know, the compromise solution that the court is proposing here is to sort of hide the subject in a place where that person cannot have interactions with the public. And so why am I saying that this epistemological commitment to individualism is problematic? Because it produces a form of alienation and a form of assimilation. First of all, it sort of excludes from the notion of religion any understanding of social relationships and belonging to social community. So, of course, a religious practice is also a sign to others and is a relationship to others, right? It's a sign of belonging within a particular social community. And when the court sees religion as an individual choice, it removes that from the scope of protection of non-discrimination. So it's very very individualistic. And if we look at contributions such as Jégi's, for example, understanding of alienation, that's exactly what happens. She describes an alienated relation as a deficient relation one has to oneself, to the world, and to others. And that results in indifference, reification, absurdity, artificiality, isolation, meaninglessness, impotence, etc. And that's what happens when, in commune danse, the person has to come to work without her headscarf, or in Ashbita when that person is isolated into a back office. So there's a bit of a paradox in the way non-discrimination rules work, because in order to benefit from them, you have to perform upon yourself assimilation. So you have to show sameness to a very stabilized understanding of what religion is in order to benefit from the protection of non-discrimination rules. And that contains a paradox, because that sameness is a necessary condition for claiming recognition and benefiting from non-discrimination, but automatically this results in inequality. And so the here anti-discrimination law becomes a sort of paradoxical device. And there is a material dimension to that, of course, because if you want to avoid assimilation and alienation as an applicant, you have to comply with those neutrality policies. You have to exit the labor market. So either you comply with the neutrality policies or you exit the labor market. And that has further material effects in terms of impoverishing and creating precariousness. So last move I want to propose is disenchanting EU anti-discrimination law. So there's a sort of a double narrative at stake here. The first one is that integration through law has been in the EU an order building enterprise in which the EU has, and I'm quoting here Loïc Azoulay, set up a quasi-transcendental system, a sort of duplication of the real process of integration at national level. And the second aspect of that enchantment is the prevalence of fundamental rights-based understanding of integration versus or over a market-based understanding of European law. So there's a sort of narrative here that EU law has emancipated itself from a purely economic understanding and that it has evolved towards a fundamental rights project. And I'm not seeking to completely undermine either of those narratives, but I'm trying to understand what forms of society EU law is actually creating. In the spirit of critical theory, we first have to disenchant that narrative in order to propose maybe a more enchanted alternative. So what society does the principle of non-discrimination in EU law construct? How does it order persons, relationships, and institutions? What inclusions and exclusions does it mandate? And here, in those two cases, LF and commune laws, but also in previous decisions, the court sort of uses anti-discrimination law to model society in a very specific ways. And this happens at the very benign level of legal qualifications. When the court refuses to qualify neutrality rules as a form of direct discrimination and qualifies them as a form of indirect discrimination instead, what it does, in line with Advocate General Medina's opinion, is to prioritize other concerns over things like social diversity, social cohesion, anti-stereotyping, etc. The court then, because indirect discrimination embeds automatically this balancing exercise between non-discrimination interests and other interests, like corporate interests in neutrality, a municipality's interest in having a strict neutrality policy, etc., the court pits the right to non-discrimination against the principle of neutrality, which is in reality a proxy for entrenching existing social hierarchies through what Moreau calls countless silent accommodations. Because neutrality is only neutral to those, you know, who are actually already accommodated. So a deeper question here is what understanding of society does that perform? So thinking with Moreau again, a Canadian philosopher of discrimination law, if the situation were qualified as direct discrimination, the wrongful nature of discrimination would then be understood as residing in the failure to accommodate those women who chose to wear the headscarf. Such an understanding of discrimination normalizes social diversity by calling out prejudices and negative stereotypes that underpin or are associated with that religious symbol and renders those stereotypes quasi-unjustifiable. So it sort of displaces the burden of accommodating these different social practices onto, first of all, those who hold those stereotypes, but also those who are in power to condemn them, in particular the employers, in a private and in a public sector. And so that move towards direct discrimination would have transferred the costs of social prejudice and the duty to suppress those negative consequences towards employers, colleagues, clients, and public service users. This has a double effect. On the one hand, it normalizes the expression of differences in society, and it promotes, as I said, social diversity, plurality, different forms of life through the principle of non-discrimination. And on the other, such a legal approximation places liability with the groups that enjoy sufficient social power to be in a position to redress discrimination. The court did not do that. It ended up qualifying again those rules as indirect discrimination, therefore transferring the costs of discriminatory prejudices and stereotypes onto the applicants themselves. And so I'll stop here. I hope that this was interesting, and I want to thank you for your attention. Looking forward to this.